I'm Brett Hayworth, and welcome to What's Your Frequency, our weekly show on Siouxland Public Media. Back in 1989, Congress officially designated the month of October as National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Some people are very dialed into the necessity of having a month set aside to bring awareness to the scourge of domestic violence and ways to lessen that, while others may not. One key statistic is that every year, 12 million women and men in the U.S. fall prey to intimate partner physical violence, stalking, dating abuse, or rape. For this episode of What's the Frequency, we're going to have a discussion on domestic abuse. And to carry that out, I've got three people from an agency called Safe Place in Sioux City. Those three are Safe Place Executive Director Stephanie Pickenpaw, Systems Advocate Margarita Morales, and Housing Advocate Rhonda Miller. Thank you guys for joining me today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want listeners to be cautioned that our conversation could be triggering for some people, so I want to share a couple of phone numbers if that will be helpful. The local number in Siouxland is 712-258-7233, and a national hotline is 1-800-799-7233. So tell me about Safe Place. How long it's been in existence, Stephanie, and what services that you all have?
Sure. So Safe Place became a 501c3 in 1980, and it was originally founded as CSADV, or Council on Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence. In 2020, we did a name change to better summarize or a better feel for how the services we provide. We do outreach services for domestic violence for Plymouth and Woodbury County, and then we do sheltering for domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking for 19 counties in Iowa.
Okay.
And we can also do Dakota County in Nebraska and Union in South Dakota.
Has much changed with the services when you went from the CSADV to Safe Place?
I think the biggest change was the doing sexual assault outreach and prevention.
Okay.
Is now done mostly by another agency.
Okay. And how many people do you have working for you? I know, is there some paid staff, and then some there's volunteers as well that work? Or
yep, we have right now 19 paid staff persons and a handful of volunteers that fill in. We do operate 24/7, 365, so it's not many staff to cover all day, every day.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any, so I shared a national statistic, do you have any statistic or two that you could perhaps point to that on services or how many people housed overnight or any, you know, things along that regard?
Each year we see about 1,300 to 1,500 individuals that come through seeking assistance.
Okay. And if a person does need to stay overnight, so like how many shelters are there throughout the 19 counties? Is there just the one in Sioux City, or is there multiple ones? I'm sorry, I'm maybe not understanding correctly.
Yep. So for victim service funding, there may be some private shelters, but we're the only one for the 19 counties. If they're established in their community, we may do a hotel stay, try to get them housed within their county there.
Okay.
But depending on the level of violence and the threat, they may have to come to our facility.
Okay, and how many, I think typically, I had a family member that used to, in Carroll, Iowa, that was a volunteer for that. I know that perhaps the location of the house might be not something that you don't necessarily say publicly, but how many rooms, bedrooms, et cetera, like how many people can you serve?
So we have 12 rooms.
Okay.
But we are never full and never turn anybody away. So we'll always find the room.
Okay. And what, when a person is contacting you for the first time, and the voice you just heard there is Stephanie Pickenpaw, she is the executive director of Safe Place, as we're talking about October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Is there calling you, do they call you directly? Is it a friend calling on, hey, I have my friend that needs to come? Or like, how are those initial calling in and getting started with your agency? How do those all happen?
So they call.
Rhonda Miller is the voice that you're about to hear here.
So when they call, we ask to talk to the survivor. We want to hear what's going on with the survivor, not other people can call, but we encourage the survivor to call.
And you're just listening for their current situation, what they've recently experienced, et cetera. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
So survivors could seek services through the crisis line calling. It can stem from calling the national hotline, and they kind of do the breakdown to what's closest to their area. And they can call the crisis line, which is 24/7, and we can provide safety planning or just giving them resources, or if they're seeking shelter or other options like seeking a protection order, maybe they need to relocate. And the other way we do outreach to victims is we get police reports on the those that have been in domestic situations or violations of protection orders, harassment, stalking, and we make contact and reach out to them and provide our services and explain to them, you know, what happens after if someone is arrested, do you need shelter? And we can go with them to hearings or from initiating a police report, a protection order. So we do outreach in that way to provide services. And then we also get the docket from the courthouse here in Woodbury on protection order hearings. So we show up to the courthouse and are available to provide support services to survivors who are going through those situations.
Thank you, Margarita. That's a very good explanation, and thank you for painting the picture of that. I very much appreciate that. So some people, it takes a few episodes for before they might reach out. Others might, like, on the first time they might. So people vary, correct? I mean, the people who are survivors of domestic abuse.
Well, we could initiate, for example, someone may walk in and they just want to talk to somebody, and it probably just explain to us what's happening, but they don't know if it is abuse or not.
Okay.
So sometimes they just need that validation, like, this is abuse. We go over the power and control wheel, and then from there it's giving them options, like, there is a way out of this, but we can't tell them what to do. We leave it up to them. And if they do choose to leave that situation, then is it, do you need a file police report? Do you need a protection order? Do you want shelter? Do you want to be relocated? Do you need to start divorce and custody? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Because it's going to look different for everybody. And then is filing a police report, protection order, or leaving that situation at that time going to be safer? Or is it going to create more of an unsafe situation? So we talk about the pros and cons of that.
Was there something you wanted to add, Stephanie?
Statistically speaking, a lot of studies show it takes about 7 times before somebody leaves for good. And the time that they're leaving is the most dangerous time, that their lives are at risk.
All right. Thank you. Back for more with this What's a Frequency show, discussing October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We have three people from Safe Place in Iowa. We have Stephanie Pickenpah, we have Margarita Morales, and Rhonda Miller. Do you guys have enough resources to do all that you want?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It's important to know, for everybody to know, that we've been level funded for 10 years. We've not seen an increase. And so it's, we try to not rely as much on state and federal funding, but that's the reality of it.
So does that mean fundraising to fill in the difference?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. We rely on donations, either monetary or otherwise, because we also accept donations for hygiene items and things to run the shelter.
Right. I think back, again, to the first time I covered as a reporter, in an event from October, again, working down in Carroll, this would have been the late 90s, they had an event after dark, like 7 p.m. in October, you know, when sun sets by that time. But it was a candle vigil, and it was very powerful to just see all the people that were holding candles. And I don't know if that's a typical thing that a lot of people do, but I know there was at least one event, if not two, one event that I think has passed, if you can tell me, and then there's another one coming up that we want to talk about as well. Yes.
Yeah. So the first Thursday of October, we always have our domestic violence vigil.
So is that what I was talking about, the vigil? Mm-hmm. Probably. Okay.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yep.
Sorry.
And then the fourth Thursday of the month, we have our human library, which actually takes place up here at WIT, where there's individuals from all parts of the system that are sitting at a table and available to talk about what they do and how.
So that will be on October 30th, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Individual did happen already.
Okay, right, right, right. But I guess I was on walking through the WIT building yesterday, and I saw a promotion for that, so or a flyer to letting people know about that. What do people tell you about the vigil for people who participate, or you know, yourselves who participate? How why does that one seem to be notable for people?
I think with previous years, we used to get a number of how many victims had lost their lives due to domestic violence. And then they stopped giving those numbers. So we, I think, changed more taking it what happens in our community. So having families speak up about what happened to their family and how they lost someone, because that seems to be more impactful. And again, creating that awareness that it can happen to anybody and it happens in our community, because sometimes people believe that it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So that's how we try to make it impactful, or it is impactful because these things are happening. So last year we had a family who had lost someone due to domestic violence who were locally. This year we did the same.
That's tough. Boy, that's tough. Yeah. I have many more questions that I want to talk about, just the whole topic of domestic abuse, of kind of some reasons and ways to help people. But I want to make sure, one more question, I guess, about your agency, and I guess for you guys personally. How did you come to work in this field, and why do you choose to continue to work? This can be probably a difficult job at times. Go ahead, Stephanie.
It's a very difficult job, like you mentioned. So I had worked previously in the homeless world.
Okay.
And came from that aspect of things, because a lot of homelessness begins with the choice to leave, mm-hmm. and that tough decision to leave everything behind.
And why do you stay in it? Like, even though it's challenging, mm-hmm. why is it important to you to serve in your role?
I think that there's a lot of defeat, mm-hmm. but those little glimpses of hope that we can give somebody, that we can create system change, that we can continue to educate people. The heart of a social worker is to eventually work yourself out of a job, right? So if everybody knows the signs and why we need to show respect and equity, mm-hmm. that one day we won't be needed. And I think on a small scale, that hope, and on a bigger scale, that will reduce violence all around.
Thank you, Stephanie. And then either Rhonda or Margarita, why did you come into this field, and why is it important that you're with the work that you're doing?
For me, I think I've always been kind of an advocacy role. One of the biggest things that is personally to me is that if I would have known that there was an agency like Safe Place when I was going through domestic violence, it would have changed so many things. So now that I know about it, and I want everybody to know about it and know that there's hope, mm-hmm. because that there's going to be points where you think there's no hope, there's mm-hmm. no help, or no one believes you. And I want people to know that there is someone that will help you, and there is hope, and there's a way out, and that we believe them, and that we're going to be there to support them. So that's always been my motivation. I wish I would have had, mm-hmm. but now that I am in this field, that I know it's there, I want everybody to know, especially small communities. I come from a Hispanic community, so I want my community to know about it too. Mm-hmm. So that's why I tried to keep advocating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Margarita. And then Rhonda.
I think that I wanted to work in this field, just having so much trauma in my life. And to help the people is very rewarding.
To be able to be there when they're at their worst, and to be there when the good things happen, and to celebrate those wins. Mm-hmm. And it's in this role as an advocate, you're their champion behind them. Like, you're not telling them what to do. You're not suggesting what they do. They find their, mm-hmm. the survivor finds their voice.
Thank you. we're back for more for this What's a Frequency show. We're discussing October, which is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We have three people from Safe Place in Sioux City. We have Executive Director Stephanie Pickenpah. We have Housing Advocate Rhonda Miller and Systems Advocate Margarita Miralles. I noticed there's been a change in terminology, or I think over my 25 years of writing about this topic or reporting about this topic. I think it's been quite a few years now, and I think the word victim has been removed, and now survivors. Why has that been a good thing in terminology to change that?
I think when sometimes you don't want to seem as the victim, mm-hmm. and that could be offensive to some people, mm-hmm. because they know they're trying to get out of the situation, or it becomes part of that victim blaming, like, I'm not a victim, I chose to stay, but in reality they are in that sense. But that's more like a law enforcement term they use, or maybe in a criminal setting, civil setting. But when we say survivor, it's like you survived this and you're moving forward and you're no longer a victim, you're a survivor. So I think changing that like stereotype of a mm-hmm. victim and not victim blaming.
Sure, thank you.
And becoming a survivor.
Thanks, Margarita. What are the key things that people can do to support domestic abuse survivors? Like, what are the tips that you think are top or, you know, most important?
Listening, not judging, validating them, believing in them. Because as soon as you start judging or questioning, that shut down the person, and they may not open up again. And then that's when they feel like nobody believes them, and they won't talk and probably feel stuck.
Yeah. Other thoughts on that question?
I just want to reiterate to believe them. Mm-hmm. I think that the individuals decided that they trust you and they're going to share it, and it's uncomfortable being on the receiving end, and you're thinking, I've not seen any of this. Mm-hmm. They seem like a great person in public, and it's human nature to say, I don't know. You know, but really swallowing that and saying, I believe you, and validating their situation, and then saying how to get help, or I don't know how to get help, but we'll find out together.
Thank you. And thanks for by saying that, getting help, that just reminded me, I want to make sure throughout the show that I give the phone number a few times for people who may have a need to call for the Sioux City, for Safe Place. The local number is 712-258-7233, and then there's also a national 1-800-799-7233. And then I have the flip side of what I just asked you. What are the unhelpful things for domestic abuse survivors, that the things that people say that are just misguided or what have you? What are the unhelpful things?
I think in the aspect that I see, like the legal system might not always, you know, officers' roles are not to be always sympathetic. They're not advocates. They're there to try to solve a problem at the moment. So a lot of survivors may feel like they didn't believe them when they get arrested, when they were trying to defend themselves, when protection orders aren't granted, then they feel like, then there's no hope that I can get away from this person, or when divorce and custody doesn't always come in the favor of the survivor or their children, and the perpetrator gets away with it. It gives them more of that power and control to them, and the system is not always fair and a straight line, mm-hmm. but we always try to still encourage them, you know, never stop reporting. I'm glad you made it this far, even though it may not be in your favor, but you're speaking up about it, and that makes a change or a difference. And so I think sometimes survivors get disappointed with how the system may respond to them, mm-hmm. from even filing a police report or getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. And another thing, on the criminal matters too, you know, when someone finally it took the courage to a survivor to report and the perpetrator gets arrested, there's not a lot of harsh consequences on the perpetrator. So the survivor may have some expectations, like they're going to go to prison for many years for what they did to me. They're going to, you know, have all these, they expect things, But the law, you know, every criminal and every victim has a right. So in their defense, sometimes they get lower their charges and they don't go to prison. And that's also a disappointment to the survivor. And we try to talk about that. Like, it's not your fault that that didn't go that way. Sometimes all is already made and he has his defense, he has his rights, and I'm sorry this happened this way, but it just goes hand in hand again why sometimes people then don't report or they don't want to be involved with the systems because of what has happened before, or even if they hear it happened to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And the voice you just heard there was Margarita Murales. We're talking about domestic abuse, Domestic Violence Awareness Month here for this episode of What's the Frequency. I want to talk quite a bit here, maybe to finish out the show, about education and the public knowing more about this situation. Do you guys have a feel for how many people talk to their children about signs of domestic? Let's talk about what are the signs of domestic abuse? As someone who is new in a relationship, what would be the signs that they should perhaps be on watch for? And if you see those, like, okay, maybe I need to pay attention.
So there's this really good website, which is the DuluthModel.org. Okay. And in that DuluthModel.org website, you will find what's called the power and control wheel. And that's something we talk a lot about in groups or on one-on-ones on what domestic abuse looks like.
Okay.
In the middle, it has power and control. It is about power and control, but they use a lot of different ways to keep you in that relationship, from using emotional abuse, verbal abuse, isolating from friends and family, using the children. Some partners may get you addicted to a substance, that financial, like retaining your money, not letting you work. So we review a lot of that because people sometimes will say, well, he hasn't hit me. Okay, well, maybe he hasn't hit you, but what other things in this wheel do you identify? And then that's how they kind of start forming the pieces, like, yeah, that's not okay. That's not a healthy relationship. And we use that a lot to educate people on what is domestic violence. It's not just the physical. It could be sexual abuse, mm-hmm. too. And using the children is very common, too, when there's children involved. And we see that a lot then when it comes to protection orders, custody. That's a way to create awareness, and people even have doubts. I always suggest going to the webpage, and it has what that power and control wheel looks like, and it has it in 19 different languages. And then there's also, depending on culture, on your religion, because that also reflects on why you may stay in a relationship. And then if you're from the LGBTQ community, it has it in that setting. So it has it in a lot of different ways. So to me, that's always was a very helpful tool in educating people and looking at it. And because sometimes you may not relate or think those are signs of abuse, mm-hmm. but they are.
Okay, thank you. And I want to talk about educational programs. And I think early on, Stephanie, one of you guys, maybe it was you, said about ways that you're trying to let the public know. Do you go into schools per se and do some sessions in elementaries or middle schools, high schools, et cetera? Is that something that's part of your agency?
We definitely try to get into the schools. Some aren't as open as others, but we work with different youth groups around the area to talk about healthy relationships and using the other half of the power and control wheel, this respect and equity, to identify everything from not bullying to teen dating.
Okay. And is there an age that would be, what would be age appropriate for someone to, for a young person, you know, I don't know, elementary or what, to start learning some tips about, you know, to mm-hmm. recognize domestic violence, et cetera? Thoughts on that?
It really starts even in preschool. We wouldn't call it domestic violence awareness.
Okay.
But we would call it like why we're nice to our friends, why we don't gossip, why we don't bully, why we don't name call. Those are the foundations that we teach our children. And I think it goes deeper into not only peer to peer, But as they get older, I mean, kids in third grade have smartphones. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, they're getting social media. And what are they saying? What do they feel comfortable online saying? And even though it's not directly to their face, it's still considered a method of power and control.
I don't know if I've asked this question. Maybe this is asked this question more precisely. Do you think that the general public, families, adults, children, whatever age, are more cognizant of recognizing domestic violence, and is it growing in awareness, or maybe not?
I believe there's still people. It's like a stigma, like a taboo. You don't want to talk about it. And maybe if you're not going through it, you're not going to have those conversations with your children. And especially also if you come from, depending on your religion, or your community, like your ethnicity, if it's not something that, you know, you're told you have to stay in those relationships no matter what, then you're not typically going to have like that other, what options do you have? You're not going to have those conversations. So we still see that, like, there's certain agencies or schools that may not want us to have those conversations with children because maybe they just don't believe it happens, or they don't want to create that awareness yet, or they feel it's not appropriate. I don't know how to word it. Like, it's that.
Well, and in the state of Iowa in 2023 passed a law that you cannot blame or appear to be blaming another race or gender. And statistically speaking, violence between intimate partners or dating happens between, that men are the predators and women are the survivors. And it can be a legal nightmare for some schools or organizations to address that safely and not appear to be blaming. So it definitely has taken off of the things talked about in schools, which makes it difficult with, we're all parenting in a new age. Mm-hmm. When kids have their locations with their friends on Snapchat or Instagram or Life 360, but how does that look differently when you have an intimate partner or a dating partner, and what to watch out for?
Thank you, Stephanie. Stephanie Pickenpaugh. We're back for one more segment here on What's a Frequency. We're discussing October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We have three people from the Safe Place in Sioux City: Stephanie Pickenpaugh, Rhonda Miller, and Margarita Miralles. And I wanted to, somebody just mentioned this a few seconds ago. Tell me about the misperception that men are not victims of domestic violence. That seems to be pretty long lasting, I think.
So that's something I always talk about. When doing presentations or trainings, that we do serve men, we do help men. Men can be victims and men can flee with their children. So that's something people always thought, we only help women. Mm-hmm. But we do help men. And I think it's just harder for men to report because of the shame or guilt, or even if they speak it out to someone close to them, they're don't believe them, or they'll be like, well, you're a man, you can defend yourself, or you're you should be tough, right? You should carry this certain type of behavior. But in reality, it does take men longer to report, but it doesn't mean that they're not victims of domestic violence.
Thank you, Margarita. Anybody else on that topic? Okay. Does a person's financial situation, or maybe even the national economy, does that impact domestic violence? Tell me any connections that are known to be with that.
We know that as the cost of eggs and milk and fuel rise, there becomes financial strain on families, and there's more stress, and people are more irritable, and things are not going to be handled in a good communication manner, and violence is going to occur.
Thank you, Stephanie. Go ahead, Margarita.
Also kind of with a financial piece, you know, if you have been in a relationship where you've been controlled from your financial aspect and you want to leave a situation, in order for you to get a divorce in custody, you need at least a minimum of $5,000 retainer. And if you've had no money or access to your money, how do you initiate that? You would have to reach out to get support, try to find services through Iowa Legal Aid if they're able to provide. So the financial burden that's one of the reasons sometimes why survivors stay in those relationships, because they feel like, how am I going to survive with my children? How am I going to support them? I haven't worked in 10 years because he hasn't allowed me. I don't even know how to, you know, get a resume, or who would hire me? How am I going to take my kids? Or maybe they were never allowed to drive. Like, I don't even know where to get to. Like, they've lived in their own little world that sometimes they feel like, how am I going to start all over?
Yeah. And as I'm hearing you say that, Margarita, I'm thinking of the control wheel, mm-hmm. the diagram that you mentioned. And you just mentioned a lot of things there of that are impact. Yeah. 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 Okay. And last thing before we leave this discussion, first of all, this has been wonderful. Thank you. I want to get into housing, how long a person can use the housing, and just kind of the basics of how you would help explain how housing works for people who come to Safe Place. Go ahead, Rhonda.
So if they're in shelter, we would complete some forms that would go, they would be put on a prioritized list. And it would go to the COC, which is the continuum of care. They would give us a referral. And if we have an opening in like the rapid rehousing, or that, they would give us that referral. And we would try to help them find housing. And the rapid rehousing program would pay for 12 months to help them get on their feet. We would also offer them services of support through the domestic violence that they had, resources that we could help them with, and that's for 12 months.
So people that come for housing, it could be a short time or certainly more intermediate or long term, yes.
Right, so certainly what the survivor needs from that emergency housing to maybe even identifying a safe family member in a few states over that we could assist them getting to following the continuum of care, coordinated entry, to getting a referral for that rapid rehousing that could pay for a year's worth of rent.
Okay. And maybe just one more on that. So like it's a bedroom, a couple, like a wing of a house, or like what when they come to the shelter, to your particular shelter, like what would that look like?
So if they get the referral to rapid rehousing, then we would help them get an apartment in the community. And we would Rhonda works with a lot of landlords to try to explain what we do, what our program, how we would make payments, and then providing case management, making sure they're doing okay, and how they're going to, once the program ends, that they have a plan on how they're going to sustain themselves so they don't lose their housing. And that's by applying for housing assistance, getting on Section 8, or if they start saving money, if they got employment. But that would be in the community that we would find them housing, and they get to pick, like, they can, you know, find a place and let us know, and we'll go with them. Rhonda will.
And before I sign off here, any other random thoughts, any thoughts that we got into and maybe I didn't ask a good enough question, or that you wanted to pinpoint a little bit better before I let you go?
I think one thing to remember is that even if you leave someone, whether you have children or not in common, that doesn't mean the abuse is going to stop. Because perpetrators, the more they see they lost that power and control over you, They may continue with more behaviors that are, they're going to continue to trigger you and try to abuse you in other ways. So that's not always going to be, people believe like once you're done, but sometimes it's more than that. So we could be providing services for a person for many years. It doesn't mean it's just a one time we help you, you're divorced, see you later. No, it's that same person can be coming back because now the perpetrator is not following the protection order. They keep violating it. They don't feel safe at home. They have to relocate or they need shelter services. They're not following the custody order. They're not doing visits. They're not paying child support. There's so many other barriers that can still continue even if you leave that situation. So, and we can still continue providing services because sometimes people feel like it's just a, I'm like, you're not going to help me anymore, or like, are you still going to be with me if I need you? And we always explain, yes, we'll be here as much as you need us to be there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The voice you just heard there was Margarita, and that will be a wrap for this edition of What's a Frequency. Thanks to my guests. We've been discussing October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We had three people from Safe Place in Sioux City, Executive Director Stephanie Pickenpah, Systems Advocate Margarita Mireles, and Housing Advocate Rhonda Miller. Thank you guys all for being here today. Appreciate this.
Thank you.
As we move deeper into our second year for this show, thanks for being a part of our station as we work every day to tell the stories about Siouxland that inform, entertain, and expand the mind. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week. What's Your Frequency airs on Fridays at 10 a.m. and again on Sundays at 2 p.m. Make sure you also check out a few of our Siouxland Public Media music shows that air at 10 p.m. We have Hip Hop Chronicles on Thursdays. We have Mixtape Dance Party on Fridays and 10 o'clock Blues on Saturdays with Stumpy Steve Smith. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Brett Hayworth.